We're looking then at these two chapters, Job 36 and 37. And I suppose the broad theme could be said to be suffering and learning. Suffering and learning. Elihu now gives what appears to be his fourth address, and this is in some ways more mild in tone than what has gone before, or what has gone immediately before. First of all, by way of introduction, he asks Job to bear with him in verses 1 to 4. And so, because it's his fourth speech, he requests patience, because he's speaking more than any of the other men. And he's giving all his speeches one after another, the other men having said all that they have to say. And he is aiming to speak on God's behalf. Verse 2, "Suffer me a little, and I will show thee that I have yet to speak on God's behalf." His great desire, the first desire, is to show and to insist that God is righteous in all his ways. And verse 3, "I will fetch my knowledge from afar and will ascribe righteousness to my Maker." He means his speech will not be commonplace stuff, or else he's saying he will bring his knowledge from afar, in the sense of he will bring general principles rather than simply referring to Job's immediate situation. But at any rate, he wants to ascribe righteousness to his Maker, the implication being that Job has done the opposite. And it, of course, it is true that at certain points in his anguish that Job did say things that he ought not. But then verse 4, "Truly my words shall not be false. He that is perfect or upright in knowledge is with thee." He is not going to use a dishonest argument. And it may be that he thinks that the other three senior men had done that. Secondly, we have God's painful discipline in verse 5 to 11. God's painful discipline. Elihu teaches that God, though mighty, does not respect persons. Verse 5, "Behold, God is mighty and despiseth not any. He is mighty in strength and wisdom." That is, he doesn't despise any because of their lowness and their smallness and their poverty and weakness. "He preserveth not the life of the wicked, but giveth right to the poor." That is, he looks after the poor even though they are poor. Those who trust in him, whatever their standing in this world, he cares for them. The wicked, whatever their standing in this world, he will judge. "He withdraweth not his eyes from the righteous, but with kings are they on the throne. Yea, he doth establish them forever, and they are exalted." That is, he makes the righteous to prosper as if they sat on thrones as kings. He establishes them. But then in verse 8 to 11, he's teaching that, on the other hand, the godly may suffer. That although God prospers the godly, yet he may cause them to suffer in order to learn. So verse 8, "And if they be bound in fetters and holden in cords of affliction, then he showeth them their work and their transgressions that they have exceeded." That is, if they suffer, it's to show them those things in which they have gone astray, or even gone over the bounds, and even into high-handed and proud and rebellious sin. "He openeth also their ear to discipline, and commandeth that they turn from iniquity." The aim is that they should see their faults, their sins, and turn from them. And if they do so, he says in verse 11, "if they obey and serve him, they shall spend their days in prosperity and their years in pleasures." So God prospers the righteous, but if he sends affliction, it's so that they will learn where they've gone wrong and turn and prosper again. But then by contrast, rebels who will not learn will be judged. So verse 12 to 14, but if they obey not, they shall perish by the sword, and they shall die without knowledge. He envisages that rebels who refuse instruction will be suddenly and early cut off, because they are hypocrites in heart. Verse 13, but the hypocrites in heart heap up wrath. They cry not when he bindeth them. The binding is the binding mentioned in verse 8, if they be bound in fetters. The hypocrite in heart, when he's bound in fetters, when he is afflicted, he doesn't cry to God as the godly do. And verse 14, they die in youth and their life is among the unclean. That word unclean, if you have a margin reference, you'll see the word also means the sodomites. What he's saying is, those who will not learn from affliction, those who are rebellious, who are really hypocrites in heart, they will be judged as the sodomites. They profess perhaps godliness, but their rebellion in response to affliction shows their true colors. Not that God knows anyway, but it brings out into the open their true colors, and they end up in the same end as the sodomites, the unclean. And then verse 15 to 16, Elihu is saying to Job, Job, if only you had learned, if you'd only learned as you ought. Verse 15, he delivereth the poor in his affliction and openeth their ears in oppression. Even so would he have removed thee out of the strait into a broad place where there is no straitness, and that which should be set on thy table should be full of fatness. We've got our terms, the strait, the confined place, and the broad place, as in Psalm 118, which we looked at last Lord's Day, verse 5. But what Job is being told here, if only you'd learned from this affliction as you ought, then you would have been brought out of your strait into a broad place, into prosperity and into blessing once again. And then verse 17 to 25, Elihu is saying, but Job, you have not responded well. That's what Elihu is saying. He's somewhat severe, though not as bad as the other three men, on Job. He says, Job, you have not responded well. Now, Elihu is saying, as becomes clear, that affliction may not always relate to specific past sins. It isn't necessarily a reflection of the fact that a believer has committed some outstandingly wicked things in the past. It's not necessarily a mark of a backsliding, but it is always for learning. And Elihu is nearer the mark than the other men. He's saying that we are to learn from affliction, even though it may not always relate to some outstanding sin, some glaring fault in the life of a believer. It is always for the development of godly character. It always has the effect, or should have the effect, of showing up remaining corruption within our hearts, so that we are humbled and learn from the experience. But what he's saying to Job is, Job, you're not learning. You haven't been benefiting. He's saying you've responded in a wicked manner. And he even suggests that's why the affliction is still going on. Verse 17, but thou hast fulfilled the judgment of the wicked. Judgment and justice take hold on thee. He's saying, be careful, Job, in case you go on rebelling, and God goes on afflicting you. And because beware lest the final state, that the final stroke of God should fall upon you and there'll be no deliverance. Verse 18, because there is wrath, beware lest he take thee away with his stroke. Then a great ransom cannot deliver thee. Will he esteem thy riches? No, not gold, nor all the forces of strength. What Elihu is saying is, Job, learn. Because those who don't learn from affliction are hypocrites in heart, and they're judged. Beware, learn, or the final blow will fall, and nothing will deliver you, not riches, not anything. And then he's saying, stop sinfully desiring death, but submit to God's dealings. Verse 20, desire not the night when people are cut off in their place. Take heed, regard not iniquity, for this hast thou chosen rather than affliction. He's saying you've got to stop desiring death, but submit to God's dealings. Instead of wanting to be rid of them by death, you must learn from what God is doing to you. And then verse 22 to 25, he's saying, Job, you must glorify God and not criticize him. Verse 22 to 25, he's saying, God exalts and God teaches as no other does. Verse 22, behold, God exalteth by his power, who teacheth like him? God lifts up men and God teaches men. God himself needs no teaching or correction. Verse 23, who hath enjoined him his way, or who can say, thou hast wrought iniquity? God doesn't need Job to tell him how he should behave or to rebuke him for allegedly wrong behavior. So don't complain of God's dealings, but magnify them. Verse 24, remember that thou magnify his work, which men behold. Every man may see it, man may behold it afar off. Others can see, he's saying others afar off can see God dealing with you, but you can't see it. But you should see it, what God is teaching you, and you should magnify God for it. Then the third main chunk of this second passage, the greatness of God beyond our understanding. And this starts in verse 26 and goes on right through the next chapter. The greatness of God is beyond our understanding. A long section in which Elihu speaks of the greatness and the goodness of God. Each part of this begins with a statement of God's incomprehensibility, the fact that God is beyond our understanding. So first of all, we have God's greatness beyond our understanding shown in the rain. Verse 26 to verse 28. Behold, God is great, and we know him not, neither can the number of his years be searched out. He's eternal. For he maketh small the drops of water, they pour down rain according to the vapour thereof, which the clouds do drop and distill upon man abundantly. He's saying God's unsearchability is shown in his control of the rain. The fact that the vapour goes up, but it doesn't come down in a deluge, it comes down in drops. God orders the rain. And he's saying this shows that God is great and beyond our understanding, that he can control the vapor and the rain in that way. Then he goes on to God's greatness beyond our understanding as shown in the clouds. This starts in verse 29 and goes on to the fourth verse of the next chapter. Also, verse 29, can any understand the spreadings of the clouds or the noise of his tabernacle? The noise of his tabernacle is the thunder. He's talking about God causing the thunder in the heavens. Behold, he spreadeth his light upon it, that's the lightning, and covereth the bottom of the sea. The flash of lightning goes down even into the sea. By them he judgeth the people, he giveth meat in abundance. He's saying there that using the clouds and rain, God both judges people and provides for people through the same means. God can cause the storm to be a means of judgment, or he can cause it to be a means whereby the ground is receives what it needs in order to provide for men. So he uses the clouds and the storm and the thunder and the rain both to judge men and to bestow blessing upon men. And then verse 32, with clouds he covereth the light and commandeth it not to shine by the cloud that cometh betwixt. He makes the earth dark by causing the clouds to come between the sun and the earth. Verse 33, the noise thereof showeth concerning it, the cattle also concerning the vapor. He's saying the thunder gives notice that the rain is coming, and even the cattle by instinct are alerted to the fact that the vapor that went up from the earth is going to come down again. Then verse 1 of the next chapter, at this also my heart trembleth and is moved out of his place. Elihu trembles at the display of the majesty of God. Job should do the same. Verse 2, hear attentively the noise of his voice and the sound that goeth out of his mouth. Then verse 3, he directeth it unto the whole heaven, and his lightning unto the ends of the earth. After it a voice roareth, he thundereth with the voice of his excellency, and he will not stay them when his voice is heard. These two verses are saying, the lightning comes first, and then the thunder. And when the lightning comes, and then the thunder comes, he's saying that the rain, he will not stay the rains when his voice is heard. When the thunder is heard, the voice of God and his majesty, then the rain will follow. And then thirdly, God's greatness beyond understanding shown in the snow and the frost. You see verse 5 to 13. Verse 5 again, we have a statement of God's incomprehensibility. God thundereth marvelously with his voice. Great things doeth he which we cannot comprehend, we cannot understand. And then verse 6, for he saith to the snow, be thou on the earth, likewise to the small rain and to the great rain of his strength. God commands the snow, he commands the dew, he commands the deluge, the great rain, the storm. Verse 7, he sealeth up the hand of every man, that all men may know his work. When he sends the storm, or when he sends the snow, everyone has to stay indoors. He sealeth the hand of every man. Men cannot get out to their work. They cannot work in the snow and in the storm. Every man has to keep his hand from his work. He has to stay indoors, that all men may know his work, that God has done this. Verse 8, then the beasts go into dens and remain in their places. Even the beasts have to stay in their place because of the storm of God, the snow, or else the downpour. Out of the south, verse 9, cometh the whirlwind and cold out of the north. God is in command of these things. And verse 10, by the breath of God frost is given, and the breath of the waters is straitened. God sends the frost. He causes the river to start to freeze over at the edges, so it becomes a narrower river than it is normally. And so the waters are straitened. Verse 11, also by watering he wearieth the thick cloud. He scattereth his bright cloud. This means he's speaking of the cloud as if it's a person. God causes by the wind, he causes the thick cloud to move here and there, so that the cloud is like a person that has to move around at God's command and is wearied by the movement. And so God uses the thick cloud and sends rain here, then he blows the cloud and it rains somewhere else. And the bright cloud is scattered by the sunbeams. Verse 12. And it is turned round about by his counsels, that they may do whatsoever he commandeth them upon the face of the world in the earth. The clouds, they move, they release the water at God's command. Verse 13. For he causeth it to come, whether for correction or for his land or for mercy. God uses these clouds. This is similar idea to earlier on. He uses these clouds to correct, to chastise, as a rod. The word correction is literally a rod. He uses it as a rod against the rebellious. He uses the same cloud for the good of the land. He uses the same cloud to display mercy. He commands them to fulfill his will. Then, verse 14, to the end of the chapter, Elihu is saying, Job, see your smallness compared with God. See your smallness compared with God. Verse 14, hearken unto this, O Job, stand still and consider the wondrous works of God. And then there follows a series of questions. Do you know when God made the clouds? How he causes the light to shine through them? Do you know these things? Verse 15. Dost thou know when God disposed them and caused the light of his cloud to shine? Do you know how he balances them and causes them to stay where they are? Verse 16. Dost thou know the balancings of the clouds, the wondrous works of him which is perfect in knowledge? And then verse 17, how thy garments are warm when he quieteth the east, the earth by the south wind. Do you know why those garments that you normally wrap to you in the cold to keep you warm, you find them too warm and hot and sticky? Because God causeth the hot wind to come. What part did you play in stretching out the sky like a looking glass? Verse 18. Hast thou with him, in other words, did you have a hand in it? Hast thou with him spread out the sky, which is strong and is a molten looking glass? Looking glass, of course, a looking glass wasn't made of glass in those days. It was made of polished metal. And he's saying, like the sky stretched out like a polished metal glass. Saying, what part did you play, Job? Were you there? What was your role in all this? If you can, tell us how to reason with God. For we are so convinced of our ignorance of his greatness that we then do it. Verse 19, teach us what we shall say unto him. For we cannot order our speech by reason of darkness. We're so profoundly ignorant of God and his greatness that we're not going to try and reason with him. You tell us if you think you can do it, Job. Verse 20, he's saying, I don't want to be introduced to reason with him because I'd be swallowed up. Verse 20, shall it be told him that I speak? If a man speaks, surely he shall be swallowed up. He's obviously referring to Job's desire for a hearing with God. Job has at different times said he wants a day in court with God. He wants to debate his case with God. And then verse 21, and now men see not the bright light which is in the clouds, but the wind passeth and cleanseth them. He's saying when the clouds are there, you can't see the sun. God cleanses the sky, as it were, by causing the wind to blow the clouds out of the way, and then the sun, the earth brightens up. Verse 22, fair weather cometh out of the north. With God is terrible majesty. God sends fair weather. He causes the clouds to blow on and the sunshine to come. with him his terrible majesty. Then the conclusions, verse 23 and 24. Touching the Almighty, we cannot find him out. He is excellent in power and in judgment and in plenty of justice. He will not afflict. Men do therefore fear him. He respecteth not any that are wise of heart. He's saying, we cannot understand God. And of course that's true, we can't fully understand God. God has absolute power. He is excellent in power. And yet he uses that power with absolute precision. You see, he says, he is excellent in power and in judgment. Now the word judgment can mean God's actions against the wicked, but it can also mean his decisions and the precision of them. That God, despite his great power, uses that power with absolute precision. And in plenty of justice, he will not afflict. That is, he will not, in his justice, afflict anyone unjustly. He's completely just. And men fear him, because none are truly wise in his sight. Men do therefore fear him. He respecteth not any that are wise of heart. No one is wise before this great and glorious God. Well, now let's assess Elihu's speech. We said at an earlier stage when Elihu started speaking that he has a tendency to put the part for the whole, and that is true. He does it in three ways. Earlier on we saw that he puts what Job said at his worst moments for what Job really believes, and in that sense he over-accuses Job. He takes Job's worst comments and says, Job, this is what you are saying, and he ignores all else that Job says. In that sense he's unfair to Job. He takes Job's worst points and hammers away at those. He also has put the part for the whole in terms of explaining unanswered prayer earlier on, just before these two chapters. He said that prayers not positively answered, the reason is that they're not real prayers at all. And he did that in the previous chapter, in chapter 35. Now that isn't the whole explanation. Sometimes prayers are not answered because they're not real prayers. You ask and you receive not because you ask amiss that you might consume it on your lust. But not all prayer that doesn't receive a positive answer is no prayer at all. Genuine, true prayer, God can say no to. The Lord Jesus himself, nevertheless, not my will, but thine be done. So again, he's put the part for the whole. The part explanation, he puts it across as the whole. We've seen those before. And also we've seen that he assumes that his explanation of the reason for affliction is the whole story. And we know that's not the case. The principal reason for Job's affliction is given in chapter 1 and 2. The challenge of God to Satan, hast thou considered my servant Job? So Elihu's explanation, insofar as it is true, is still only part of the reason, or one of the reasons. It's not the whole picture. So again, he tends to put part of the picture as if that's the whole picture. However, we must take account of the fact that Elihu is not later rebuked by the Lord as the other three men are. And evidently then, we must say at least that Elihu's speeches represent a marked improvement on the other three friends. They were just wrong. Elihu is much nearer the mark. He understands the difference between chastisement and judgment more clearly than the others. He still has the idea of instant retribution being the norm, that God instantly punishes the rebel in this world, which is not always the case by any means. But he understands more clearly the difference between chastisement and God's judicial wrath against the impenitent, the unbeliever. He also recognizes the place of affliction in sanctification, even when it's not relating to some specific sin committed. He understands that affliction is to teach, and that is true even for the godly, even when someone is not in a backslidden state or is not guilty of some out of the ordinary sin, that it is a general part of God's dealings with his children to teach them through affliction. The trial of your faith, being much more precious than a gold that perisheth, though it be tried with fire, shall be found unto praise and honor and glory at the coming, the day of the Lord Jesus Christ. Also, we can say that at the end, though he hasn't fully applied this to himself, he acknowledges the greatness of God to be such that he is beyond our understanding. And therefore, Job did overstep the mark in making his inability to see why God was doing these things to him a reason for complaining against God's doing these things. Now, Elihu could perhaps have been better in terms of sympathy and encouragement to Job, but he evidently is correct in saying that God, because we can't understand the mind of God, therefore God's dealings with us are sometimes beyond our understanding. We don't know why God does things. Now, Elihu himself has tended to think that he does know, but he does acknowledge at the end, in chapter 37, that we don't know, that God is incomprehensible. And therefore, sometimes we can know some of the reasons why he does things, but not all of the reasons. And therefore, if we can't make head nor tail of what God is doing, that is no reason to say God shouldn't be doing it. So evidently, Elihu's speech is not adequate as a full answer to Job. But it was adequate as a significant run-up to the Lord's own answer, which comes in chapter 38. So Elihu is much closer to the mark than the other three friends, but it takes the Lord's answer in chapter 38 to fully deal with Job. What are the lessons? First of all, the same outward affliction may be for the correction of the godly and for the warning of the wicked of final judgment. That much is clear at several points throughout these chapters. God will always distinguish between his people and the ungodly, between his children and his enemies, both in this world and in the next. And so the same acts of God that seem to affect and afflict the godly and the ungodly can have a very different significance with respect to the two groups of people. God can correct and afflict his children for their learning, but he can send the same afflictions upon the ungodly to warn them that if there is no repentance, there will be final judgment. So the same event affecting two different people with the same measure of affliction can have a different significance for those two people. But it takes faith to understand that. Secondly, affliction is for the sanctifying of God's people, even if not related to specific transgressions of the past. Job was meant to learn. He was meant to learn. Because although Job was a godly man, and although Eliphaz and Bildad and Zophar were quite wrong in saying Job is suffering much because he sinned much, he's a hypocrite, whatever he seemed to be, he must be a hypocrite or he wouldn't be suffering in that way. They were utterly wrong. And any suggestion that Job was suffering because of some specific outstanding sin he committed or some backsliding from the Lord, well, all such suggestions were wrong. Job was a godly man. He did fear God. He did eschew evil. He was upright. Despite all of that, Job still had things to learn. And so Elihu was right on that point, that Job was meant to learn. Because although we're given the reason, but as far as what was going on between God and Satan, yet although God does everything for his own glory, it is always also in the interest of his people. So Job's afflictions must have been for Job's good, as well as for the glory of God and the vindication of his name and the demonstration of the reality of the kingdom of grace in the life and in the heart of Job. It was also in Job's interest. And so he was intended to learn. And however godly a man may be, he's not perfect in this life. And affliction is a means of learning, as we saw in that psalm which we sang. Thirdly, affliction is better than sin. Affliction is better than sin. Better to be afflicted than to sin. That's God's priority. He afflicts his children so that they'll sin less. That means sin is to be feared more than affliction. We live in a day where human happiness, or what is thought to be human happiness, is seen as all important. Happiness in the sense of trouble-freeness. That's all important. And Christians can think that. We can become dominated by that thought. Our aim in life, be trouble free. Our aim in life is to be holy. It must be. And therefore, affliction is better than sin. Better to be afflicted, to be holy, than left alone to sin. Fourthly, affliction either teaches or embitters. Affliction either teaches or embitters. And Elihu has some sense of this in chapter 36, verse 11 and onwards, that affliction, either a man who is genuinely godly learns through it. I don't say that a godly man may not go through a process of bitterness and then learning, but ultimately he learns, whereas the false professor, the hypocrite, becomes embittered. John Flavel says, a cross without Christ never did anyone any good. And Derek Thomas says, the wise man rides the wave, the fool is drowned in it. Afflictions either do us good or they embitter us. And in the case of the ungodly man, they embitter, they harden, unless the Lord is pleased to use that affliction to change him, as he does sometimes use affliction as a means by the regeneration of the spirit of bringing a sinner to repentance. But otherwise, it embitters the ungodly man. And as I say, even the believer, it can take time for him, by God's grace, to learn. He can go through bitterness and then learn. Fifthly, we must seek to see God's greatness in his daily providence, in the rain, the clouds, the snow. Elihu did. Jonathan Edwards, we're told, or he mentions in his diary, that he used to love to watch thunderstorms. Before he was converted, I think he used to be frightened of them, but when he'd become a Christian, if he saw a thunderstorm coming, he used to get positioned in the window of it and used to watch the lightning and listen to the thunder, because he saw the majesty of God in these things. He wasn't afraid anymore. He knew who was in control of these things. We are not very, to use James Durham's phrase, we're not very thrifty at gathering lessons of God's greatness from common things. Not very thrifty. We don't make good use of God's daily providences to gather up lessons to see his greatness. Sixthly, we must seek always to exalt God in his works. Even affliction, afflictive providences. Poor godly Job struggled with this in the extremity of his anguish and affliction. He struggled to magnify God in what God was doing, even though it was causing him such pain. Elihu, perhaps we might say, he could have been more sympathetic, but his doctrine was correct, that Job was duty bound to magnify God in his works, even when those works brought him into terrible affliction. Job struggled with that in extreme affliction. We struggle with it in any affliction, if we're honest, most of us. The least trouble, and we don't magnify God in his works. We don't see God's hand, or we don't choose to see it, or we don't welcome it. Finally, we should acknowledge that we only know in part, and this we've stressed at other times. Our little minds, coupled with our pride, we tend to think that because we see one reason why God does something, that we know all. That if we can see one purpose in what God is doing in a particular thing, that we know the whole picture, and we don't. Sometimes we're struck, we see, yes, I can see now how the Lord was working in that. And we can see, looking back, how God's providence, the wisdom of God in it, that event, that providence, which was so bewildering at the time, and then later on, yes, we can see, isn't it wonderful, the Lord was working there. We couldn't understand why it happened at the time. Now we see why it happened. Yes, but we don't see the whole thing even then. Even then, we only see one reason. You see, God's providence covers everything that happens. Everything that happens happens in the providence of God. And all that happens, and all the interwoven nature of events that God brings about, we cannot know all the repercussions of any single event. We might sometimes get a glimpse of one particular effect of an event, but we don't know all. Because God's plan, worked out in providence, is immensely complicated, far beyond our grasp. And so even when we do see the operation of his hands, we only perceive some of the picture. And so